Welcome back to Slightly Foxed, and a departure from what you might expect from us, because this month we're looking at graphic novels. And for any literary purists out there pursing up your mouths, think again. Storytelling using pictures does date back to the 11th century or even earlier, with works like the Bayeux Tapestry. And surprisingly to me, at least, the concept of the drawn novel was born in the late 1800s. So this is a genre with a very long history, and today we're delighted to have a very distinguished and very entertaining contemporary graphic novelist with us to explore her own work with a fellow expert in the field. But first, today is a landmark day, because having recorded all the podcasts remotely since March 2020, we are finally back around the Slightly Fox kitchen table at Hoxton Square in East London. And even more wonderfully, Slightly Fox editor Hazel Wood is back with us at long last. Hazel, we missed you.
Well, it's lovely to be here. I'm really happy.
It's lovely to see everyone, because here with us in the flesh, we have fellow Fox Stephanie Allen.
Hello. Lovely to be here. I'm quite emotional to see everybody again.
It is, isn't it? Yes. And series producer, yes. Lynn Jones, who, I mean, I haven't seen any of you for whatever it is, 18 months now. You did all grapple brilliantly with remote recording, I have to say.
Doing it from the sitting room with the door going and cars and
farm
delivery
machinery,
vans.
If I remember.
Yes, yes.
Various dogs.
Dogs.
What I do remember is that sort of very nail-biting minute when I wondered if I was actually going to make contact with you all or whether I was just going to be sort of sitting.
I think it all went remarkably well, actually, because this is recording over the way, but it was new to all of us. Lynn and I had done very little of it before. And yet, well, we didn't lose any podcasts, did we? It all happened. So time now, I think, to introduce our guests. Though Posy Simmons really needs little introduction, at least to long-term readers of the Guardian newspaper. She's a cartoonist, writer and illustrator, perhaps best known for gently skewering the British middle classes in graphic novels, including Gemma Bovary and Tamara Drew, both of which became internationally successful films starring Gemma Arterton. Most recently, she published the rather noirish Cassandra Dark. Paul Gravett is an expert on comics and graphic novels. Back in 83, he co-launched Escape magazine to showcase alternative cartoonists, long-standing director of the Cartoon Art Trust, and he curated an exhibition of Posy's work in 2018 in London, and Paul, I think, another one now in Switzerland.
There's one in Basel, that's correct, yeah, till October 24th.
Posy, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Tell us how you came to be a cartoonist, because I don't imagine there were that many women working in the field when you first started.
There weren't. I mean, there were one or two. There was Anton in Punch, who was part of a brother and sister combo. On The Guardian, there was Belsky, who did political cartoons. Sally Arts, who's still drawing away. There were one or two. There have always been one or two.
Yeah, that's more female names than I was expecting, if I'm honest. Mm. And I never know how useful it is to get definitions of genres when we're talking about literature, but I wonder if we might have a go at just defining the difference between graphic novel and cartoon strip.
Well, it's tricky to the graphic novel defies definition, which is one of the most exciting things about it.
Yeah.
In some ways, rather like the novel itself, we wanted to do surprising things. The novel was originally novel, as in new. Yeah. I guess the main distinction, of course, is that graphic novels are in book form, typically, and therefore the idea is that a graphic novel is a comic that you need a bookmark for, because you might not read it all in one go. But as a term, in its modern English language usage anyway, it goes back to 1964, when an American dealer and publisher named Richard Kyle, who wanted to encourage American creators of comics to step away from the disposable, ephemeral nature of comics, whether they are a newspaper strip or a monthly or weekly comic like The Beano or Batman, and to think of something that was going to last and be made for a book, in fact. And he invented the term in 64, graphic story, and from that, graphic novel.
I was intrigued when I started digging into this, because in my head, I had imagined that was about as early as we'd be going.
Mm.
But then I see there are mentions of the drawn novel in Le Figaro, the French newspaper, in 1894, mm-hmm. amazingly. And this is where we get into competitive library collections, isn't it? Because I brought a couple of books in that are definitely, to my mind, graphic novels from the 50s.
But you've got one with you that is way earlier than that.
Well, I have. This is a really important book because it's from 1873. It's called Ali Sloper, A Moral Lesson. It has 750 pictures by Marie Duval, one of the world's first woman cartoonists. And the words are by Judy's office boy. Judy was a competitor to Punch.
The magazine?
Yes. Punch began in 1841, and then in 1867 there was a rival magazine called Judy. Ali Sloper, if you imagine what he was like, he was a big influence on W.C. Fields, in the sense of having the top hat and also being a bit of a reprobate and liking his drink. And it's a very, very London comedy. They compiled the episodes into this lovely little paperback, including a new, mostly text, fake biography of Ali Sloper. It's quite meta because it's very knowing about the character. Is he real or not real? It's about the staff on the magazine encountering him coming into the office and causing chaos. He became a phenomenon, selling about 500,000 copies of his weekly magazine, Ali Sloper's Half Holiday. He was in merchandise. He was on the music hall stage. And this is all before The Simpsons or Felix the Cat, any of that.
It's surprising, especially that knowingness is surprising to me, at least so early on.
Yes, and I think that example makes us rethink how far back can we go. And of course, the other definition would tend to be that it has to be printed, it has to be available in multiples. I mean, I'm very keen to include the Bayeux Tapestry, and we can go right back
if we want.
We can go right back to cave paintings, of course.
Or the Parthenon frieze.
Absolutely, the frieze, Trajan's column. But in theory, you're meant to have multiple copies.
Okay, so that is a useful definition, isn't it, I suppose. I came across another one published in 1946, which again was a bit earlier than I was expected, and it's called Citizen 13660. And that really blew me away, because that was written by a Japanese-American woman who was interned after Pearl Harbor in the US. And it's about her experiences, and it's very funny, but it's very acid. It's a proper graphic novel, isn't it?
Yes, it's an important example. One of the other questions about what defines a graphic novel is, does it have to have balloons?
And
quite a few speech balloons.
Yeah.
Yes, speech balloons.
Just to be clear.
Because there are quite a few graphic novels which use typeset text beneath the panels or around the panels. And Posey, of course, you use quite a lot of text, typeset text, in fact, in your graphic novels. So that's one of the areas of debate, shall we say. But yes, Mina Kubo's work is remarkable for its time as well. It was absolutely current, dealing with a very urgent issue at the time. An issue that hasn't gone away because in the last year or two, there's been a major graphic novel produced by, would you believe, Sulu, as in Star Trek's pilot, George Takei, has written a graphic novel about his family's experience, including himself, as Japanese interned Americans.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
so they kind of bookend the experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's serious subject matter. I mean, he's dealt with wit in the book, Citizen 13660, but she's not pulling her punches, is she? So she was definitely making a political point.
Absolutely.
In graphic novel form. This was 1946.
And it has been reissued, I think, recently.
We were also talking about, was it France?
Mazurille, who did woodcuts. He did. Have you seen some of those?
I haven't actually, but I was looking up something else and I just sort of came across him and he sounded so fascinating.
Definitely.
And he was political, wasn't he?
Very much so. He was a Belgian artist, but he was very concerned about the rights of workers and the difficulties of people surviving in a modern society. This is around the 1920s or so. Yeah. Several of his books have been reissued by Redstone Press, but they're an unusual format. They were printed only on the right-hand page of each spread and there were no texts at all.
It made me think sort of how international these are. Really.
It is actually a whole genre in itself. Mazurille was one of the pioneers, but not the only one. He was invited to China, partly because of his political points of view, I think, and there he was a big influence on local artists developing comics.
It's a truly international genre, isn't it? I mean, way ahead of its time in many ways. I promise I'll bring us a bit more up to date in a moment, but I just cannot resist talking about Jules Feiffer.
Yeah.
Now, I pulled a couple of books off my own bookshelves, and I must admit, I hadn't looked at them before because they weren't my books, but they are the most fabulous graphic novels and they date from the 50s. Mm-hmm. Now, Jules Feiffer, I think initially published as a cartoonist in the Village Voice in New York, but look at this wonderful one. I've got it in front of me. It's called Passionella and Other Stories, and it's the Cinderella myth. It is wonderfully funny and wonderfully drawn, isn't it? We've all been having a look at it. It, again, is very knowing. Certainly got some points to make about personal appearance and the importance of, you know, what matters in a relationship and that sort of thing. Oh, I did a bit of digging and found a review by Kenneth Tynan, the fearsome British literary critic, who was obviously a huge fan.
Pfeiffer's got quite a theatrical approach to comics in a way. I mean, his comic panelling is often full figures. We were laughing at the beautiful dancer sequences.
Yes, the Dancer Spring.
Yes, which he's quite famous for. Yeah, and also, of course, what he's done here, interesting and parallel to Posey in a way, is that his works have originally appeared in magazine form. He's a journalistic cartoonist. You mentioned Village Voice, also there was Pageant. Uh-huh. And then he is adapting them to make them work as a book. You have the effect of the spread. Every turn of the page gives you a new surprise. It's a very good way of pacing a story and developing the narrative.
And they're redrawn for the book form, aren't
exactly,
they, importantly? So this isn't just cartoon strips in a book.
No.
It's an adaptation.
It's conceived as a book. Yeah.
So very much in line with your own work. Mm.
They're tremendously modern, actually.
Aren't they?
In the storyline.
Yes. It's all about depression and relationships and, you know,
and physical appearance.
Pfeiffer's still going strong. He's been making recently a trilogy of new graphic novels that's come out.
How old is he, Paul?
He's getting on a little bit, I should say, yes. But yeah, of course, he had quite a quick career in movies as well, writing screenplays.
More recently, would it be fair to say there was a bit of a blossoming in the 70s and the 80s? I'm thinking about Art Spiegelman and Mouse.
I would think Mouse, I mean, it won the Pulitzer Prize, and it was one of the first ones I read. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I was bowled over by it.
So for people who don't know it?
It's autobiographical. It's the story of Art Spiegelman's father in Poland under the Nazis and Auschwitz. I mean, it's a very dark story. It's also about Art Spiegelman's relationship with his father in the present. So it's got these two time frames. It's brilliantly done. I mean, it's harrowing, but it's also funny too. The best sort of combination, I think.
Definitely. And I think Spiegelman also is subverting the medium by using funny animals. I mean, the cat and mouse, it's called M-A-U-S, the German spelling of mouse.
Yes.
And the Nazis are all cats and the Jews are mice. In fact, there's complications. Spiegelman has a French wife, Françoise Mouly, and she's portrayed as a poodle, I believe. And I know there was some frissons and difficulties because I think he at one point had to show Polish people, and I think they may have been portrayed as pigs,
yes,
which did not go down terribly well with some.
Very few, I don't think there's mention of, are there British?
I think there might be British bulldogs.
Were they bulldogs?
But this is an old tradition of personifying nationalities by animals. And of course he's subverting it and playing with that. But also in a very dark way, by portraying the Jews as mice, it also reflects on the fact that is it Zyklon, I think, was the name of the gas that was used? Well, that was used on rats. And as we know, the Jews were demonised by the Nazis as being pests to be exterminated. And also, with Spiegelman, he draws incredibly simply. In fact, what you may not realise is that Spiegelman began by drawing in a very, very worked, rendered, expressionist drawing style to try and get across all the angst, and realised it was too heavy. And so he stripped his drawing down and actually drew it the same size as the printed page. You may not realise, but mostly comic artists, including Posey, draw considerably bigger,
bigger.
At least half or twice up sometimes. He wanted to draw it as if you had picked up the original drawing of this diary.
Interesting.
This was like finding Anne Frank's diary or something like that. And so it
gives
it an extra immediacy. Yeah.
I know what else I wanted to ask you about. Daughter of Her Father's Eyes. So this certainly, I think, is one that people will know about because it won the Costa Biography of the Year in 2012. This is Brian Talbot and his wife, Mary M. Talbot. So, Paul, tell us a bit about that one.
What's unusual, first of all, of course, it got nominated. That year, by the way, there were two graphic novels nominated for Costa Prizes. Daughter of Her Father's Eyes won in the biography category, but there was a graphic novel in the novel category. And that was even more. My goodness.
Really put the cat among the pigeons.
That was Days of Bagnold Summer by Geoff Winterhart, which I know, Posey, you loved as well. Wasn't it just wonderful?
I loved that. The drawings are wonderful. It's about this, I suppose he's about 16 or 17. It's his summer holiday with his mum, and it's all going to be downhill the whole summer. The way the story unfolds, he does the expressions so well. He goes into the mother's rather unhappy life and also the awfulness of being a boy that age with sort of an awful long summer stretching ahead. It's just brilliantly done.
But presumably it was very contentious putting that up for an award.
It was. And in the case of Brian and Mary Talbot's book, this was an unusual biography because it was a combination of autobiography and biography, because Mary Talbot's father was a Joycean scholar and was also quite difficult as a father, quite remote. And so what Mary decided to do was to propose a kind of dual biography comparing essentially her experience with a difficult father and Lucia Joyce's experience of James Joyce, her father, and how in many ways her life was difficult and wasn't as fulfilled. She wanted to be a great dancer, she had many other ambitions, and contrasting Mary with her ambitions, which she's fulfilled to become an academic in her own right, and etc. And so there are two contrasting styles and palettes in the book. Tremendous that it won, very important moment. At the same time, it created a certain debate as to whether these visual books, these books with pictures in, my goodness me, whether they really belong alongside or should be competing or seen alongside books that don't have pictures.
Okay, what do we think about that, Posy?
I think some of them can be seen as novels, absolutely, like novels without pictures, completely.
Yeah. As you just described, those are novelistic themes, aren't they? They are complex, they are deep, they are thought-provoking. If that's not a novel, what is?
Yeah, I agree.
You think so too, Hazel?
Yeah, I do.
And I wonder whether there's a distinction between children's books and the slightly more serious subject that then turns it into a novel.
Yeah.
I was thinking of Raymond Briggs, because I was a huge fan of Fungus the Bogeyman.
Right.
I actually had the Fungus the Bogeyman plop-up book, which was brilliant. And then when he published When the Wind Blows, that was really quite a shock. I remember my parents bought that for me, thinking, you know, I enjoyed Raymond Briggs. And that was harrowing.
How old were you?
Well, young enough for it to have a real impact on me. And I just remember the illustrations of the elderly couple after the nuclear explosion.
Oh, yeah, have we actually said it's about a nuclear attack on Britain by the Soviet Union, isn't it?
And I think obviously there was a lot of anxiety about nuclear war at that time.
Very, very frightening. It was actually, because we were all quite preoccupied, really, weren't we?
Yeah.
I mean, I went on an Aldermaston march when I was a teenager. Mm. So the shadow of the bomb was something that was very present.
But it's interesting because he'd really been seen as a children's author.
Exactly, that was the big departure, but he still used the children's book format. One of the challenges is the children's books, as you may know, tend to have about 24 pages, and that's your lot. And he had a lot more panels to fit in than he could. So several of the spreads, you probably remember the nuclear explosion spread, spoiler alert, but it's basically a piece of white paper with a tiny bit of singeing around the edge, because it's just wham, it's the bomb going off. But there were several double page spreads as the menace of the bomb approaches, which meant he had even fewer pages and then had to fit in a lot of teeny tiny panels. I mean, there was one of the most intensively panelled graphic novels around.
Have you ever seen the artwork?
I've seen some of it, yes.
Was that same size? Or
it was bigger.
It was a bit bigger, I was going to say.
Yeah, it does work out bigger. Yeah. And of course he's gone on to did Ethel and Ernest, which was another breakthrough book, which actually became such a bestseller that it really sparked Jonathan Cape getting into graphic novels in a very, very serious way. And that was the story of his parents, which of course were the basis of Jim and Hilda Bloggs, who were the characters in When the Wind Blows. But this was their real life, going through a century almost of huge social upheaval. And very touchingly, both of them dying at the end of the story. It's a tremendous work.
I mean, as you say, publishers started to get more serious, presumably that was just about numbers, wasn't it? They saw, you know, there was a real market for this stuff.
Definitely.
I mean, you were talking about style and format, and it'd be interesting to hear a bit more about that, Posy. I mean, how do you work?
Well, Gemma Bovary and Tamara Drew, of course, weren't graphic novels to begin with. I did them in The Guardian, and so they were serials, and the format I was given. So I remember them saying, right, you've got 100 episodes, and the shape of it will be three columns wide by the depth of G2, which was a shape a bit like a giraffe. I remember thinking, because I've been used before to horizontal, you know, strip cartoons tend to be horizontal. I can remember thinking, oh, wow, I mean, this is very weird. But actually it became a shape that I really enjoyed and I found rather adaptable, because you could chop it up into bits or halve it, and it gave you many more layers. And each layer, if you wanted to, could be a time change, or it could be someone different speaking. So that was Gemma Bovary, which was in black and white. And Tamara Drew, again, I was given 100 episodes. I did more, in fact. And that was in colour. Two episodes once a week. That was a bit of a sweat. I got a bit behind times. And so by the end, it was really,
I mean, columnists complain about a weekly column. That's a lot.
Yes, it was. I was a bit knackered at the end.
But it's just a comic, Posy. I mean, surely you can just toss these out, aren't you?
That's what people...
They do think it's an
nice.
Easy
you,
thing
you,
to do.
If you draw, people usually say, what fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Writing is such a sort of factor in your work, isn't it? I mean, does that take you longer almost?
Yes, it takes longer.
Yeah.
I mean, to get the speech balloons right and to get the text right. Because I was short of space in 100 episodes, I had a lot of story to cram in. I used the text to do some parts of the story because it took up less room.
Yeah.
So you could kind of say things like he'd been divorced twice and was now on his third, etc. On the other hand, you never needed to describe anybody because you just drew them. You know, if it was a man with a ginger beard and a long grey coat, there he was.
The detail in your drawing is so fantastic. I remember thinking, you know, if it's a French coffee pot, it really is a proper French coffee pot. And I think you said, you know, that it's the equivalent of description in a novel, as it were, that incredible detail that you get in and trueness to life.
Yes, I would agree that it's all about recognition for the reader, so that if it is a French coffee pot or a piece of habitat crockery from, you know, the 1960s, it will ring some bells.
It's part of the pleasure. It sort of gives you a kind of thrill of pleasure to kind of recognise it somehow.
Oh, well, I'm glad about that.
I know what you mean. But it also works for you, Posy, as messaging. Because as you say, it's a condensed message, isn't it, if it's a particular sort of coffee pot.
And your names are also so brilliant. I think a lot of writers fall down over names. But I loved, you know, people like Kevin Penwallet. In Trisodit.
Trisodit, especially.
Okay, we're going to have to explain, people who are not familiar with this, what Trisodit is.
This was part of the strip I used to do for The Guardian in the 70s and 80s, and it's an imaginary Cornish fishing village. It's called Trisodit, quite near Trelost. And Kevin Penwallet was the purveyor of decorations done in shells or schooners scratched on bits of slate. He had a shop. So I had quite a bit of fun with that.
But you work on paper, don't you? Not on screen. Is that right? A lot of people work on iPad now, I think, don't they?
A lot of people do. And students I speak to, well, some of them still use pens and paper and crayons and inks. But a lot of them slightly raise their eyebrows when they say, I can't find your font for balloon lettering. And when you say it's hand done, they sort of go, well, why would you bother?
Oh, wow.
You can. But I do work the old way. But I'm quite interested in learning because you get interesting effects. But I still like the It seems to me very immediate. You think of something, then you draw it. It comes out of your hand.
And as Paul was saying, they're much bigger than the stuff you see on the page. How much bigger are they?
Strips for The Guardian in the 70s and 80s were very big. That was partly because it smudged and fine lines wouldn't come out. Gradually, its printing became much, much better. And so by the time I did Gemma Bovary, you know, I could use half tones. And then with Tomorrow Drew, there was colour and very well printed.
My husband always remembers you saying that you like cross-hatching to Vivaldi. Is that still the case?
That was true. And also Bach, anything with a sort of very regular rhythm.
Well, I can see how that would work with cross-hatching.
Yes.
That's a window on your world that I think we're all going to enjoy now.
It's a wonderful title, Cross-Hatching to Vivaldi. It's got to be a book called
so
that,
is.
Doesn't it?
Actually, sounds like a podcast, doesn't it? I mean, I did want to ask you about structure. I mean, how far ahead do you plot at any one time?
With Gemma Bovary, of course, I had Flaubert's great novel,
indeed,
Madame Bovary, as a sort of background thing. When I'd thought of the idea, I reread Flaubert's novel and then I shut it in a drawer. I'd had the idea of making my Madame Bovary British, and she would have bought a cottage in Normandy. So I'd got the bones of the story. I knew, like Madame Bovary, she would die, and I wrote out a kind of shape of the story. This will happen then, this will happen then, and towards the very end she will take an overdose and that will be. And I can remember doing the drawings for the bit where she was going to take the overdose and sketching her kind of the pills and the letter she would write and her lying on the bed having taken them. And she wouldn't die. She sort of sat up and said, I don't do this sort of thing. And I realised she wouldn't, because in the course of the novel, she changed. She would reinvent herself. She was quite a practical person.
Yeah, she wasn't Flaubert's Madame Bovary.
She wasn't Flaubert's Madame Bovary. So then very quickly I had to kill her rather than she killing herself. But I think often when I was used to deadlines, when you're kind of sitting on a pile of hot conkers, as it were, ideas kind of come very quickly. And so I worked out how it was done.
You must be pleased with that, because it's a great solution.
Well, it was a relief, I have to tell you.
Was there ever a possibility of more episodes? Did you ever go, I need more space? Because that's a constraint, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It was a constraint. People, especially the French, have always said, it's got far too much text. This isn't really a graphic novel at all.
Interesting.
And I can remember them a rather French conversation where two critics were saying, but what is this? You know, mais c'est quoi? And they discussed it, and eventually they satisfied themselves by saying, well, it's not really a graphic novel, but it is an illustrated novel.
A roman illustré.
And then they were very pleased.
Then they felt better.
And then they felt much better.
C'est pas de la bande dessinée.
It's not bande dessinée, which is what the French call comics, but it is an illustrated novel.
And that is a lovely illustration of the discomfort that the literary world, I think, and readers, you know, still have with graphic novels. This sense of they can't quite get their arms around them, and what are they, and why isn't there a proper definition?
Well, I mean, I can remember my aunt, who, when I was about to do Gemma Bovary, and I said, it's going to be a graphic novel, and she rang me up and said, oh, it's not going to be too graphic, is it? I mean, she thought it was going to be absolutely filthy.
Well, some people do think the graphic is short for pornographic, and it has got that.
Well, it's also it's a problematic word. Graphic novels, so to speak?
There are certainly plenty. You can have another programme on those, yes.
Okay.
But it's a problematic word in itself, because you get non-fiction graphic novels, because the novel's meant to be a work of fiction. But then, of course, so when Mouse was in the New York Times bestseller list, it appeared originally on the fiction top 20 because it was a graphic novel.
Yeah.
And then Speakman had to ring up the New York Times and say, oh, excuse me, but the Holocaust did happen. It ought to be on non-fiction.
Factual. Yeah. Yes.
So it's a word we're slightly stuck with, in the same way we've been stuck with comics, which assumes it's going to be funny.
Funny ha-ha, yes.
Exactly, and can't be serious.
I mean, it is interesting, this question of how bookshops handle graphic novels and where they put them. And I gather this is something of a vexed issue.
There's an argument to say that ideally graphic novels would actually be sitting alongside their appropriate section. So you'd have science fiction, graphic novels along science fiction, but you'd have Poe's work would be simply alongside all the other works of great modern fiction.
Would it be fair to say that on the continent there's generally been a bit more acceptance about this as a genre than in the UK?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I read an awful lot of comics when I was a child and then had a big gap and didn't really look at comics or graphic novels. I read Mouse, and then on visits to France, I can remember going to supermarkets, and there would be adult bande dessinée, and there would be children's ones. And if you went into a big bookshop like Fnac, there would be adults reading their lot, and on the floor there would be children. But it's a market that certainly has grown hugely.
It has. I think you could say a lot of it relates to the mid-60s onwards, when a lot of cultures, not just France, realised that the comics could be more, could be books for a start. I'm also very interested in comics in Asia, and I'm passionate about manga comics from Japan, which is just another extraordinary comics culture in its own right. It's as big as almost everything else in the world put together. And by the way, I know you've used the word genre, but for some people listening, real devotees, will bristle a little bit at the word genre.
I apologize.
Which is only just because it suggests that it's stuck in something like being superheroes or fantasy.
Yeah.
People prefer it to be referred to as a medium because it is something quite special and distinct, say, from film or from plays or from pictureless prose.
Yeah, I can understand that. But kind of going back to the kind of affirmation, we need to talk about Persepolis, don't we?
We do.
Oh, yes.
I mean, Marjan Satrapi, Iranian-born, experienced the regime, the rise in the regime of the Ayatollahs, and her book, Persepolis, came out at the absolutely the right time, post-9/11.
In Paris.
She enabled us to get inside what life was like in Iran and to understand and to empathise. It's one of the things, perhaps, that's the most important thing about comics, is that they have a surprising power of building empathy in the reader.
And the darkness is creeping into your own work, Posy. Your latest one, Cassandra Dark, it is dark. Isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Yes. I suppose it reflects rather a dark time. I live in London and I walk a lot. And 4 or 5 years ago, I was just aware of more food banks, more rough sleepers, a sort of divide from the very glitzy bits of London, like Knightsbridge, and the poorer bits. And it reminded me of Dickens.
Yes.
Victorian London. Mm. And so that was partly a decision to base it slightly on Dickens, A Christmas Carol.
And have you noticed that your books, when we were talking about books being displayed in bookshops, whether your books have sort of moved from shelves at the back to central displays? Because I find that with Persepolis, mentioning, you know, that really, it was always on the front table. As soon as that came out, it seemed to break through various barriers. And we actually did it for our book group, our only graphic novel that we've done for our book group.
I'm pleased to hear. I mean, I thought Persepolis was absolutely brilliant. Mm. Yes. And it just shows what a nimble thing a graphic novel can be. I mean, particularly for telling autobiographical, because it's very personal. You get the drawing as well as the voice. Mm. And I would also say The Arab of the Future, which is, now there are 3 or 4...
I think it's going to be 5 or even 6 volumes. It's still going, in fact. Yes, yes.
And this is about Syria. And the first two were before the war. So I should think there's some very painful ones coming.
Yeah, still to come.
Yeah, that's been a huge success. Yeah. Riyad Satouf is the artist,
I think one thing that we maybe haven't touched on is I feel that Posy is very unique because you're writing books, and you're writing books with a literary inspiration. And I love that. I love picking up those little bits in Gemma Bovary and Tamara Drew, which you based on Far From the Madding Crowd.
I mean, I have to say that it doesn't matter if you hadn't read Hardy or Flaubert or even Dickens. If you had, there would be something extra.
Oh, there definitely is. I agree with Steph. Yes, there's a whole other layer of enjoyment if you've read the
pleasure, yes. I mean, in that sense, someone like Alison Bechtel we ought to mention as well, I think, with Fun Home, which has got a lot of literary subtext going on. Autobiographical, again, she's a lesbian American cartoonist and her father died in mysterious circumstances and was a closeted gay man. And remarkably, it's been turned into a Broadway musical, which basically hasn't happened to you yet, Posy, but I'm sure it could.
As long as there's some tap dancing.
So, Paul, for people who are intrigued by the discussion we've just had, there are specialist bookshops and there are festivals, aren't there? So give us a few pointers.
Yes, there are. Most major cities in the UK have got comic shops, and certainly in other countries will have even more. I mean, London, one of the very best for graphic novels is Gosh. Their whole ground floor is devoted to the field. And then, yes, there are festivals. One of the best is coming up runs every year in Kendal in the Lake District. It's called the Lakes International Comic Art Festival. Interestingly, they're the only comics festival that's part of the Arts Council England's programme of big, serious funding. We can have film festivals and literary festivals, but this is the comics festival we're going to really get behind. That's coming up quite soon. Also in November in Harrogate, there's the Yorkshire Comics Festival called Thought Bubble.
Thanks, Paul. That brings me to a final question, I suppose. What next for you?
I think more of the same. I'm not toying, I've started another graphic novel.
Have you? Mm-hmm. Oh, we're delighted to hear that. Any idea when we might see that?
Maybe sometime, like Captain Oates.
We won't press you. Yes, Posy, Paul, thank you. Stay with us. We're going to have book recommendations in a moment and another Book Lovers Day Out coming up after this. Slightly Foxed is a publishing house based in East London. It was founded by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. The team began publishing a quarterly magazine about all those great books on publishers' backlists that can be so hard to find in bookshops. They also reissue out-of-print books they think deserve a new generation of readers. Everything they publish is beautifully produced, from their pocket-sized cloth-bound hardbacks to illustrated collectible editions for children. Posted out to subscribers in 80 countries, the magazine itself is a collection of readable and entertaining articles about all sorts of books, fiction and non-fiction. The contributors are equally varied. Some are distinguished writers, journalists or academics, while others come from very different walks of life. The annual subscription to the magazine is very reasonably priced. Even better, your subscription gives you free access to the searchable digital archive, and that's over 1,000 articles to explore.
sign up for an annual subscription at foxquarterly.com, or if you'd rather speak to a person, give the London office a call on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Okay, book recommendations, Hazel.
Right. Well, I haven't been well and I was looking for something sort of light to read. And on my shelf, I found a book called Burnt Diaries by Emma Tennant. And Emma Tennant wrote 40 books, I think. I suppose it's a bit of a sort of little flyer for the next podcast, which will be about yes. Sylvia Plath. But Burnt Diaries is actually about, well, first of all, the starting of her literary magazine, Bananas, and the chaos of that, and also mainly about her on-off affair with Ted Hughes.
So Sylvia Plath's husband.
Sylvia Plath's husband. And as we know, he was very charismatic, and he certainly used that sort of charisma to get people into bed. And she found him quite irresistible, but very alarming.
I think that seems to have been universal, doesn't
yes, it? Yes, I mean, yeah. And this book someone described as her being dewy-eyed and beady-eyed, because she does sort of get Ted down to a T, and also the kind of ridiculousness almost of their affair. The first time they go to bed, she can't really get over wanting to be, you know, not just a lover, but a terribly promising pupil. And as they get into bed, she finds herself saying, "Can you tell me about metaphor?" Which completely sort of puts, you know, the kibosh on the whole thing. And then this is the ridiculous business of the magazine Bananas, which was actually a serious magazine, you know, and J.G. Ballard. I think the book starts with the word wham, which is when his book Crash, okay. The manuscript of it sort of lands on her bed. And, you know, all these people going in and out of this very run-down house in Notting Hill, to which she'd moved from better times in Chelsea. Anyway, she has to get money to start it off. And she has the idea that her half-brother, Colin Tennant, who was Princess Margaret's great friend, up at his strange mock baronial castle in Scotland, might have photographs that have not been published. And she thinks of perhaps going up with her friend Rosalind for a holiday and maybe just lifting one
right. And
selling it to the press. And they go up together, and it's terribly nail-biting. Everybody at Glen, you know, with it's described with all the sort of hideous tartan carpets yes. And tartan everything. There's nobody there, and she tiptoes into the room where all the albums are, and she does find a photograph of Princess Margaret. Rosalind is, meanwhile, sort of hanging about at the door, terribly anxious. But they get away with it, and they go back to London. But then she doesn't really have the nerve to kind of know what to do with it. And people get so fed up with her, they keep saying, "Oh, for God's sake, just sort of do something about it." But when she hears that it's been discovered and all the nannies in the house had been interviewed by People's Police, she completely loses her nerve and tears it up and puts it down the loo. But it won't go down. And, you know, bits of naked Princess Margaret are sort of floating about in the bowl. Anyway, I'm making it sound very frivolous. I mean, it is in many ways, you know, a rather sort of sad book because, yeah. Of course, in the end, Ted does die. Yes. And, of course, lurking in the background always is Sylvia Plath. But, I mean, Ted's sort of incredible use of his charisma to get everybody into bed and is kind of faintly ridiculous as well. Anyway, I greatly enjoyed it and I do recommend it.
You make it sound irresistible, absolutely irresistible. So, Posey, what do you have for us?
I've just been reading Old Ways by Robert McFarland. He's an incredible walker along trails, footpaths, paths on land, paths on water. His writing is wonderful, very poetic in many ways. I will never take a walk even round London now without thinking about what the pavement's made of, or am I passing buildings made of London stock brick? Or he is interested in everything, the weather, the birds, the stone, the mosses, in the sea, the currents, the fishes, the dolphins. It's a really extraordinary book. I couldn't manage to do what he seems to do, which is to climb up vast shelves of granite very easily and then sit on the top. He swims in very cold burns and lochs. But it makes the landscape come alive in an extraordinary way. No, it's a brilliant book.
Thank you. Paul?
I brought along a book called Our Time, produced by the Lakes Comics Festival and published by Soaring Penguin Press.
And this is brand new. Is that
brand new, yes. And there are four stories, and one in particular stood out to me. It was by Michael Lightfoot. It's called Looking for Love in Brexit Britain. And what's really striking is it plays with one of your favourite, the genre of the girls' comics, the romance comic. It's based on the fact that Michael himself voted for Brexit and actually set up an artist's for Brexit group. It is fictionalized,
yeah,
but it's based on the trope of the romance story where boy meets girl, boy loses girl in one sense. But it also, importantly, it deals with a sort of taboo, a subject that we haven't talked about, which is the prejudice that has been applied to many people who have voted for Brexit, the shame, the fact that many people don't admit that they voted for Brexit,
yes,
and the effect it has on relationships. And even in publishing this book, it's created frissons and issues amongst the comics community, which is, I would say, probably mostly anti-Brexit, in fact. As Tove Jansson said so wonderfully in her Moomin books, she said, how very different people are. And we should be celebrating that difference and not being putting up barriers.
I think that's a very, very interesting concept. A truly original idea at this time.
And yeah. I think comics may have got there first.
Steph?
Well, my recommendation is actually a slightly foxed reissue.
That's allowed.
First time I've chosen one. It's Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. And this book follows in the tradition of great walks and is the second in his trilogy, which starts off with Side with Rosie.
Which everyone knows.
Which Midsummer Morning follows that wonderful description, but with a much more serious undertone, because he leaves his home in Slad in Gloucestershire. He sets off to London, works as a labourer for a year, and then decides to walk around Spain. And he just walks here, there, across, round. It's fascinating. Covers history, geography. He enters a country where there is great poverty and the undercurrents of the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, he doesn't pull his punches, does he? You won't say this, but I'm going to say I've actually bought that edition you've got in front of you. It's a beautiful little cloth-bound.
It's very
Speedwell blue book. It's a lovely book.
And the illustrations are by Leonard Rossaman, who taught Hockney. Beautiful illustrations.
That's such an interesting array of recommendations. Thank you all very much indeed. Now, Steph's had to be on her way, so Hazel's fellow editor, Gail, is joining us now with another Book Lovers Day Out. But first, I have to say, hello, Gail. It's so good to see you.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Now, you have been off to, I know it's a favourite destination of yours, it's Gilbert White's house at Selborne.
It is. It's in northeast Hampshire, not too far from where Steph lives. And in the summer, she and I had a day out there. Gilbert White, of course, is famous for being the author of The Natural History of Selborne, which has never been out of print since it was published in 1789. The first book on man's relationship with nature in the English language. He's the father of ecology. And his house, which is on the High Street in Selborne, it's where he moved when he was eight, and he died there in 1793. And he spent much of his life in correspondence with friends and in his garden recording the natural world. The house itself, you can see his bedroom with the bed hangings that his aunts embroidered for him, the study where he wrote and so on and so forth. But the house has been added to since. But the garden has been restored to much as it would have been when he was there. So there are six wonderful flower beds, which were called quarters, which is a Georgian term for plot of land that was being cultivated. And each one represents a different element of the seasons. There's the tulip tree he planted, which is now a magnificent specimen. There are hotbeds where he grew melons and cucumbers, which are basically made out of straw bales and a great deal of horse manure.
Okay.
There's a flower meadow, 12 acres, which is now scythed once a year. Same tools as he would have used. There's a herb garden. I was an absolute paradise. I just loved it. And Steph and I just sort of wandered from, you know, one bit to the next. And the whole garden sits beneath a rather remarkable geographical feature, which is a chalk hill covered in beech trees. And it's there are quite a lot of them in that part of Hampshire. They sort of rise up out of the landscape. And Gilbert White actually created a zigzag path that goes to the top of this hill, which you can still walk. And I can tell you it's a stiff old climb. The cafe uses produce from the garden.
It sounds idyllic.
It's just heaven. It's just heaven. I mean, there's so much I could say about Gilbert White. Just go and enjoy it. The other thing, curiously, Posey was talking about Lawrence Oates, and I may be some time. The house was acquired by a trust with money from the Oates family in the 1950s on condition that they kept two exhibitions of Frank Oates, who was a naturalist, and his nephew, Lawrence Oates, who, of course, was on Scott's Antarctic expedition and sacrificed himself to try and help save the others.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to see.
You can book tickets online, but rather joyously, you don't have to. So spontaneity is coming back into our lives. You can just go if you're passing. Thanks, Gail.
Pleasure.
And that is it for this month. It has been fabulous to be back at Hoxton Square and to sit round the table with everyone and talk face to face. Posy, Paul, thank you both so much.
It's been a great pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
I think we'll probably do a bit of a mix and match of round the kitchen table and remote recording in future. But today has been lovely. We will be back on November the 15th when, I'm delighted to say, we'll be joined from the US by Professor Heather Clark, the author of the acclaimed biography, Red Comet, of Sylvia Plath. All the books and writers from today's episode are on the website, as usual, foxquarterly.com, along with many beautifully produced books and other good things. Dare I point out that Christmas is coming. Until next month, thank you for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.